This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
Here we are, and we're with
Jackie Scharfenberg.
Jackie, you are a ranger, a naturalist?
I am the naturalist with the Kettle Moraine State Forest Northern Unit.
Wisconsin State Parks, it's all under natural resources?
The Wisconsin State Park System is under the Department of Natural Resources here in the state of Wisconsin.
Tell us where we are. This is a really special place for you.
It is a special place. It is a place that was created by the glaciers of the last ice age, and the remnants that they left behind left a really unique topography that's here that we can enjoy today. When the glaciers came down out of Canada, they came down with two huge lobes, one going down Green Bay and one going down Lake Michigan. And they kind of sideswiped each other and deposited debris in between them as they began to melt. And what they left when they melted back for the last time was called an interlobate moraine. It's a ridge of hills that runs for about 120 miles. And it's really unique in that if you would go to the space station and look down on the state of Wisconsin, you can actually see that ridge of hills.
Wow, that's interesting. So very distinctive.
Very distinctive. We don't have the Appalachians or the Rockies, but we have the hills of the Kettle Moraine, that interlobate moraine.
As we were talking about earlier, in geologic time, this happened yesterday.
Correct, in the last blink of the eye. So time hasn't had a chance to wear it away. It hasn't eroded away. It's still pretty prominent on the landscape.
So 10,000 years ago here, we'd be sitting on top of a glacier.
Or at least seeing the end of the glaciers just beginning to retreat. Be more tundra-like, like you would see up in Canada today.
So you guys have created a hiking trail that follows that glacial moraine area.
We have. It's actually a national scenic trail called the Ice Age National Scenic Trail. It had a start with a dream from a man by the name of Ray Zillmer. He really wanted to preserve the Ice Age legacy of Wisconsin. So he worked with Henry Rice, who was a congressman from Wisconsin, and Gaylord Nelson, who was a senator from Wisconsin, who also was the founder of Earth Day. He didn't get to see his dream come to fruition because he passed away before it did, but the Ice Age National Scenic Trail is one of his legacies, and it follows the southern extent of the glaciers in the state of Wisconsin. When it is complete, it'll be between 1,000 and 1,200 miles long.
And with the National Parks and National Forest Service, this is a more recent iteration in types of parks, right? That you have a linear park.
Correct. It's in the same vein as the Appalachian Trails, but the National Park Service didn't have this as part of their original plans. So the linear trails are fairly new for the park system, but they've been around for 40, 50 years now.
Okay. Sell me. Why should I go on this hike that we just did? You know, why should we recommend it to people? What is special? What are you going to experience that's distinctive?
You're really going to get a cross-section of Wisconsin, and you're really going to see how the glaciers impacted and really reshaped Wisconsin's landscape. And it's also a great way to meet the people of Wisconsin as you hike along. It's not quite like remote like in some of the mountain ranges of the Appalachian Trail, but there have been people that have thru-hiked the whole trail, even though it's not totally complete yet. There's a lot of road connectors. It's just a great way to experience Wisconsin in a much more relaxed, laid-back kind of way.
And the trail, is it mostly forested with deciduous trees, or are there open savannas, or what do you experience?
You're going to experience all of that because the glaciers left us with all kinds of different topographies. Some of it's going to be very forested and very rugged. Some of it goes through national forest lands. Some of it goes through oak savannas, which are more park-like. You might go through areas that were outwashed plains or old lake beds, so they're going to be more flat and prairie-like.
Speaking of the ancient lake beds, what physical evidence do you see and experience as a hiker along this former glacial moraine? Striated rocks?
Yeah, you can see rocks where the glaciers like literally scratched into the bedrock. Those are called striations. You can find places that are like gullies where, again, rock kind of just cowered into the bedrock. You can find rounded rocks that were left behind by the glaciers called erratics, in addition to the different landforms like gumdrop-shaped hills called cames, or the sinuous or snake-like hills called eskers created by water or rivers flowing underneath the glaciers. You can find kettles that were made by big, giant chunks of ice that melted and formed these depressions in the ground. You might have places where the meltwater just gushed out and formed these huge deltas. So there's all this unique landform that the glaciers left behind.
And again, you're looking at the Earth kind of upside down, right?
Yeah, the glaciers left us with a topography that's upside down. So things that were under the glaciers during the Ice Age today are high, like the eskers, the kames. Things that were above the ground, like the big ice chunks that melted, today are low.
That's interesting. Bit off subject, but not necessarily so. And today, in the modern forests that we walk through, we see dead and dying hardwood trees, and there's a very specific problem.
Well, one of the major causes of our tree death here in the forest today is emerald ash borer. It came into the Detroit harbor back, I think it was about 2000, and this little beetle attacks ash trees of all varieties, green, white, blue, and black, and the grub eats under the bark and actually girdles the tree and kills it. Right now, we don't know of any cure for it. We can help slow it down by reducing the amount of ash trees that are in an area. We can reduce the spread by not moving firewood around or other wood products that might have it in.
It's a real epidemic, isn't it?
It's a huge epidemic. Think of it raiding out of Detroit. It's already made it to the East Coast, and it's made it to the Mississippi River and slightly beyond.
Wow. And to mitigate that, it's reforestation. Tell us a little bit about that.
As we reforest or looking at our rec areas or even in our cities, because ash was planted a lot after Dutch elm disease, they plant a lot of ash because it grows nice and straight, grows fairly quickly.
It's a great street tree in urban America, isn't it?
It's a beautiful street tree, and it's a native tree. So what we're doing now is planting in a whole variety of other hardwoods. And we're also looking a little bit at planting trees that might be just a little bit south of our range, like sycamores and pin oaks, to help mitigate maybe some of those effects of climate change.
Very cool. I'm going to let you go. I know you got to go save the forest and get rid of the mosquitoes.
Well, mosquitoes are a part of it, but yeah, plan for them.
Okay. For further information,
you can contact Jackie Scharfenberg at jackie.scharfenberg@wisconsin.gov.
Website?
You can go to the Wisconsin DNR's website, and there's links off of that.
Jackie, thanks for sharing. What a great hike today.
You're very welcome.
Except for the mosquitoes.
Except for the mosquitoes.
Yeah. All right, I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Wisconsin. We'll see you here.
My name is Gary Henschel, and I'm the owner with my wife of Henschel's Indian Museum and Troll Farm.
Here we are. We're way out in the country.
Yes, we are.
And how did you come to have the Indian Museum?
Well, I started collecting when I was a young boy, and started to put them in a little building, and then I had people visit it. And from there it's grown, and now we have lots of school groups and things people come through. So
you have a real strong affinity for the indigenous people that lived here.
Definitely. I think when you find an arrowhead, you start asking questions. And you ask, well, who are these people? What were they hunting, and why are they hunting with this type of tool, and where's this stone from? So that sparks your interest.
So school kids and individual people come out to your museum to see and tour?
Yeah, we open in the summer, we have hours, and we take appointments throughout the year, but mostly it's summer. Yeah. And then we do the school groups and other community groups as well.
You have a trout farm here too. I love trout farms. When I was a little kid, man, I thought that was the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, it's an unusual combination, but a lot of times we'll get people to come to the museum or to the trout farm. Mm-hmm. And they'll do both.
So when did you come up with a trout farm? How long has it been here? Did your dad start that?
Yes, my dad started it. He started it in the late 60s. And first he was just going to make a duck pond. And then somebody told him, well, put some trout in there. If they grow in there, everything will grow. So it's located where there are springs. So ever since then, we've had trout.
Now you have ducks, too.
Yeah, we have ducks, too. My daughter actually raises them in her classroom. Then we bring them out here later. Everybody loves the ducks.
So where are we located, and who would typically come to see you, and how would they find you?
Well, the Chamber does advertising for us through their Elkhart Lake publication. We do send out brochures to various businesses. We've had a lot of people come from different communities doing articles. It's brought people in. I think our biggest one is that people tell other people about it. And when somebody has somebody come to visit them, they'll say, well, we know a place we can go take and show you. So we really have had people from all over the world.
A lot of people just dropping in, right?
Yes. Yeah. I don't really have to go anywhere. I meet all these really neat people.
The world comes to you.
Right. Not a lot, but, I mean, it's interesting. Yeah. And then we've had archaeological digs, and they set it up on field schools, so people will come in again from other places.
So you have a lot of university students here in the summertime then.
Right. Yep. We've had 9 years of people digging here.
How would somebody find out more? Do you guys have a website?
We do have a website. It's Henschel's Indian Museum and TroutFarm.com. So you can learn a little bit more about us there. We're just a small museum, but we have a lot to offer.
How far are you from Elkhart Lake and from, say, Milwaukee?
Okay, from Elkhart Lake, we're about 5 miles. From Milwaukee, we're about 50. We're also about 50 miles from Green Bay. So it's kind of right in between Lake Michigan and Lake Winnebago.
So a day trip for a lot of people.
Yes, right. Yep.
All right, Gary, thank you so much for sharing.
You're welcome. Thank you.
My name is Tom Castrivas. I'm one of the co-owners of the Throttle Stop in Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin.
What a pleasure to come here and meet you and see the stuff you have here. Frankly, I was surprised. I did not by any means expect to find what I found here.
Yes. We've been doing this for 30 years. We have quite a eclectic collection of vehicles from late model to vintage, high-end, import, domestic. We have one of the finest motorcycle collections in the country. We have a collection of over 50 motorcycles.
Some of the vehicles here are for sale, right?
Yes, the majority of the vehicles are for sale.
Some are keepers?
Well, some I'd like to keep, but I'm in the business to sell.
Right. It's interesting, there's a very famous racetrack here, and that's one of the reasons why you settled here?
That is correct. It's Road America. It was established in 1955. It's a 4-mile road course with 14 turns, different elevations. And for professional racers, it's one of their favorite tracks in the world. We've had some of the most renowned drivers race at this facility, and it is second to none.
It's an interesting paradox in that, as you mentioned earlier, you get some walk-in traffic because of the racetrack, because of the races. But on the other side of the coin, you said you could be located anywhere today because of the internet.
Correct. Our business is 75% internet-driven, and 75% of the vehicles and motorcycles go out of state or out of the country. We just delivered a vehicle to France.
Very, very interesting. So talk about a couple of the more precious, exotic cars that you have here. I mean, the old Jaguar, for example,
right,
is classic.
We have a 56 Jaguar XK140. Jaguar in that era dominated racing. They won Le Mans 3 years in a row, which is one of the biggest races in the world. It's in France. The other rare vehicle I have in here is a 1973 Porsche 911 Carrera RS 2.7 liter. It is one of the most iconic Porsches ever manufactured. It's a $1 million car, and we have one in stock. There's only 14 that exist in the lightweight version. They made a touring version and a lightweight version. This is a lightweight version. It's got a magnesium engine block. It has thinner metal in the body, and it has thinner glass to make the car light to have better performance, and we do have one in stock.
You do this because you have to have a way to make a living. But you also do it because you're a car guy and it's in your blood. You've done it since probably high school.
I did it, started this in high school. I paid my way through college, my tuition with restoring vintage Corvettes. And it's just a passion I've had since I was a child. My father was a car collector. He loved automobiles, and I just followed in his footsteps.
You have some amazing engines themselves, standalone engines that are right here in the showroom.
Well, engines are like artwork. We have vintage motors. We have a Gurney Eagle vintage V8 with Weber carburetors that was used in the 60s vintage Ford GTs that dominated racing. We have a Ford 427 Camry motor that dominated NASCAR racing in the late 60s. And these are like pieces of art. They're very collectible and valuable.
Personally, one of the coolest things that you have here that got my eye the minute I walked in, as you noticed, was a turn of the 20th century bicycle, a gas-powered bicycle.
Yes.
Tell us about that. That's incredible.
We love history, and we acquired a 1913 Gladiator, and that was the beginning of the bike era and track racing with bikes, and it's just intriguing, the simplicity of the bike in the engineering of the bike for that era.
It's a bicycle, but then was retroed with a gasoline engine, and if I'm correct, there's a connection with Schwinn.
That's correct. They used Schwinn frames to make the motorcycle, and that was the beginning of the motorcycle era with Harley-Davidson, Indian, and there were other manufacturers, which the Gladiator was another manufacturer.
Somebody doesn't have to come to see you here, like you said, because of the internet. They can see you on the web. So how would somebody see what we're talking about?
What they do, just go to our website. It's thethrottlestop.com, and you can view all our beautiful cars and motorcycles on that website, even take a peek at our facility.
Tom, thanks for sharing.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you coming. My name is Tom Kostrevis. I'm one of the co-owners of the Throttle Stop, and we'd be happy for you to take a look at our site.
Thanks again, Tom. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Wisconsin. We'll see you here.
So I killed him?
You totally killed your fish. You are an official fish hunter.
Tom, can I ask you for a favor?
Yeah,
of
course. Want me to hold?
No, I got it.
Jay Brickner, Jay's Guide Service.
And you've been doing this all your life?
22 years.
But you've been fishing since you were tiny.
Yeah, guide mostly on Elkhart Lake.
Typically, who signs up with you? Who goes out?
A lot of people from the Chicago area come up here quite a bit.
I imagine a lot of families.
Yeah, families. Sometimes mother, father, daughter.
And you have all the gear,
yep.
Whatever anybody.
I supply everything, the equipment, the bait.
And how long do you typically take people out for?
Usually I do about a four-hour trip.
And mornings would be the most common?
I prefer to fish the mornings out here, yeah. Does get a lot of boat traffic later in the day. There's a slow no wake speed limit till 10 in the morning, so nice and calm out here in the mornings. Nobody's skiing or anything. It's a lot easier to fish.
And how about towards sunset?
That's a good time to fish, but typically I prefer to fish the mornings.
So what would it cost the minimum to go out?
My minimum fee is $130.
And that's one person?
Yeah, otherwise it's like $80 a person.
And if you had, say, a mom and dad and a kid, what would they plan on?
Usually I would charge about $220 for three people.
What is the most rewarding?
I would say the kids, especially the kids catching their first fish or their biggest fish or, kick out of that. It's something they'll never forget, probably. So that's probably the neatest part of it.
What type of fish do people typically catch?
Largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, and walleyes. There's a little bit of everything. There's bluegills, crappies, perch.
So say you have a family and they catch three, four, five fish decent size. What do they do with them? How do they get them out of here? Do you process them for them?
I would clean them for them if they'd like, but generally the people just want to come out and catch some fish and throw them back in.
So 95% is catch and release.
Yeah, at least. Probably like 99%, I would say.
Can I have a worm?
Yep.
Did you lose your worm?
Do you want me to hook it?
No.
Okay. I did lose my worm. Maybe a fish ate it.
It might have. Kind of nibbled away when you weren't looking.
Okay, so now I'll grab this.
Oh, I can do it.
No, that's right. The way you cast is you hold the line like this. And then flip that over. So your index finger, just bring it back like this. Grab this rod, maybe go in the back. Somebody can fish in the back.
What's your name?
Natalie.
Natalie, where are you from?
Los Angeles.
So this is your first time fishing?
That's correct.
And what do you think so far?
I'd say it's a not so stressful situation. It's pretty relaxing.
Yeah, I think that's why people like fishing.
Yeah, it's nice to be out on the water. I mean, I feel a bit bad about catching it and if it gets hurt and throwing it back in. But I do see the appeal in catching and eating your own food.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's really cool. Uh-oh.
Uh-oh, what?
I would reel it up and cast it out again.
What's your name?
Annette Benedetti.
First time fishing? Or?
No. I grew up fishing in Idaho. I grew up in Idaho fishing, yeah.
That first time in Wisconsin?
Yes.
And why do you like fishing?
Being out in nature. It's peaceful on the water. And I think also just because it's like what I grew up doing for, you know, vacation and pleasure and relaxation.
Did you go family fishing when you were a kid?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My dad would take me out. We had a boat, and he would take me out on lakes and rivers, and we'd spend the afternoon. That was kind of the thing I did with him.
So, yeah, it is that tranquility and getting away from
the
normal.
Very meditative. Mm-hmm. I feel like as far as leisure time activities and stuff like that, it's one of the more remote things you can do these days. You know what I mean? I guess in a way it's kind of old school, too.
And it's one of those things that's easy to do. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have, like, go skiing. You don't have to lug your skis and boots and poles, and
right.
It's real portable.
Yep, and there's so many different ways to do it, too, right? So we're doing cast and reel right now, or you can go and get a boat and troll up and down rivers, and, you know, there's a variety of different ways.
Well, your worm is still working, right?
It does not look healthy at all. I don't know if it's going to stay on very long.
Unscrewed, I should say.
Yeah.
And so he taught me how to let go of the line.
Uh-huh. So right now you can see your line is paying out.
Does that mean that there's a fish biting?
No, it means it's dragging.
Coming off right now. It's sinking to the bottom. It's probably on the bottom now.
How deep is the lake? Well, where we're at.
The spot is 180.
And where do they want to be? Along the bottom?
Yeah, the fish are going to be on the bottom. There's weeds down here, and we're going to be fishing through the weeds.
Oh, it's my first fish.
Okay, bring him over here by me and I'll get him out.
Can we take a picture?
Yeah, he's hungry.
This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Molly Blaisdell, San Francisco, and Katya Singel, San Luis Obispo, California.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
The Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative was recently awarded the prestigious Phoenix Award by the Society of American Travel Writers. HLRI was one of four recipients of the prestigious award that recognizes international organizations actively involved in conservation, preservation, beautification, and anti-pollution campaigns that further the growth and appeal of travel destinations.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. And in fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
Seventy-five years ago, World War II ended. It was the deadliest military conflict in history, resulting in 85 million casualties. We mark the anniversary of the end of that war by celebrating the heroism of our greatest generation,
those who served, and those who supported their efforts at home. On September 2nd, we will commemorate the signing of the Articles of Surrender aboard the battleship Missouri Memorial at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, a celebration of the peace that followed. Salute their service, honor their hope. Join us virtually for the events on September 2nd, 2020. For further information, go to 75thww2commemoration.org.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.